Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, the topic, the body-mind-self, and the epigenetics of our culturally learned beliefs on that health and our quality of life. Joining me will be Dr. Mario Martinez. He is a clinical psychologist specializing in psychoneuroimmunology, as well as anti-aging. And for the past couple of decades, he's been developing the discipline of cultural psychoimmunology as a mind-body theory that explains how our thoughts and their biological expressions co-emerge within a cultural environment and history, which in turn affects our immune, nervous, and endocrine systems. This model is called cultural psychoneuroimmunology. He is the founder of the Biocognitive Science Institute in Uruguay, which is now in Nashville, Tennessee, and he conducts research and lectures and offers seminars in biocognitive principles and mind-body techniques. He was the first to outline a blueprint for a new paradigm on the epigenetic relationship between cultural beliefs we hold and the quality of our health. His latest work is Mind-Body-Self: How Longevity is Culturally Learned and the Cause of Health Inherited. And more about biocognitive mind-body science and workshops and events can be found at the Institute's website, biocognitive.com. Nice to have you with us, Mario.
Hi, Gary. It's good to be with you again. It's a pleasure.
Mario, always enjoy having you return to the program. Since our audience continues to grow larger and there are many new listeners, I feel we should first start with you again giving us an explanation about the fundamental principles of psychoneuroimmunology, especially this epigenetic interface that exists between the neurosciences and cultural anthropology. And this would include our inherited belief systems and socially accepted demands and expectations that populations are indoctrinated into. And in your answer, also explain what is meant by our bioinformational field and the role it plays in either staying healthy or triggering illness and disease with respect to our immune system. Take your time. The forum is yours.
Okay. Thank you, Gary. I'll start with a quick history and then move on to your question. My mentor, George Solomon, Dr. George Solomon, was at UCLA in the 60s, and he found that the immune system responds to our psychological processes. This is working with women who had rheumatoid arthritis, and the way that they responded to the world affected their triggering of the rheumatoid arthritis or not. So he called it psychoimmunology, and they almost laughed him out of UCLA because you know how it is when a new paradigm comes in, the first thing is disdain and so forth. So then later, a few years later, Bob Ader found that the nervous system is also related. So they called it psychoneuroimmunology. Then they went on to the endocrine system, psychoneuroimmunoendocrinology. It went on and on and on, like the almost like the Frankenstein effect. So there's been a tremendous amount of research looking at how the nervous, immune, and endocrine system are affected by our thoughts and our emotions. But I think that what was missing was the next step, which what I am trying to promote here, is that psychoneuroimmunology is not just the same all over the world. Our brain is cultural, so therefore our biology is cultural. So I'm calling it cultural psychoneuroimmunology to explain that the culture really is the best way that I can explain it now is that the world has infinite possibilities of interpretation. And the culture or the collective belief of a group weaves a fabric around that world, and then what the culture and the cultural brain sees in that group is the fabric rather than the world in some kind of monolithic way. And we have cultures that are, as you know, some of the Asian cultures are more collectivist, and our United States and Britain and Australia are more individualist. So the brain learns individualism or collectivism. So if you show somebody a picture of somebody sitting on a bench, and you ask them to remember, an individualist culture will say, well, I remember he was wearing a blue shirt and he was sitting in this place. You ask an Asian person what they remember, they say, well, he was sitting at same thing, but there was a tree behind him. So it's a relational kind of mindset that they create. But for example, more specifically to the immune system, you can shame somebody, and if you're an individualist culture, you shame that person takes the shame as a personal offense, and they have inflammation. The immune system will cause molecules of inflammation like interleukin-2 and tumor necrosis factor and other molecules, and you have an inflammation. And how is that possible? Because the immune system is biosymbolic. Symbols, like words, it responds to, because as you asked me to explain, the bioinformational field is that we are animals that can communicate with language and symbols. So in order to be able to survive, the mind-body process needs to understand those symbols. So animals have epigenetics. If one animal eats poison, for example, all the other animals that are close to them won't eat it, but also the next generation doesn't eat it, which is an epigenetic transfer. And we lost a lot of that because we have language. Now we can tell our children, don't eat that, it's poison. But it's still biosymbolic. So then you have inflammation. But if you say something to somebody in a collectivist like Japan and Korea and China culture, they will have inflammation, or they will have shame if they consider that the shaming is the shaming of their group, of the family, or rather a relative kind of thing rather than the individual. So even the immune system can respond and can actually discern between a collectivist and an individualist insult.
I'm going to take this in a slightly different direction now, and it'll take a few moments, so please bear with me on this. But I want to connect several points that I have noticed in my own career, because I was a colleague of Dr. Lawrence LeShan, Larry LeShan. Are you familiar with Dr. LeShan?
Yes.
Okay, and he was motivated by Dr. Han Selye. Are you familiar with Dr. Han Selye?
Yes, the founder of, or the discoverer of stress, what we call stress now.
Yes. And I also remember meeting, I wasn't a friend of, but I met and interviewed Dr. Han Selye, and all the people who were a small group, Marty Shepard, Albert Ellis. These were people who were looking to see that body-mind connection, but before anyone had really brought it together. And so you would have little groups of individuals who would talk about, well, it is our belief that if you're in a happy marriage, you're going to be healthier. If you're in a bad marriage, you're going to be sick. If you live in a nice environment, a bad environment. So they were making these connections, but we didn't really have the papers on them, and hence it hadn't been codified into general principles of acceptability. And I was working at that time as a research fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology and Anti-Aging Medicine. And I kept noticing something, because we were affiliated with Trafalgar Hospital across the street. And I kept noticing that once a person got into their cancer ward, they rarely did well. And I asked the director of the institute, I said, would you be willing to try something, especially with your patients who are terminal? He said, what is it? I said, why not bring in people who believe that through their mind and emotions, they could put up a better fight against cancer? Right now, it's strictly biochemical. They're getting radiation or chemotherapy or some combination, but otherwise, medicine is not employing anything that we would call the humanistic input, nothing spiritual. He's okay. And at that point, I brought in some people who believed in therapeutic touch, who believed in body, mind, emotion, and they began each in their own way of talking with people. And I remember talking with a woman named Stern, who had been my editor. I didn't know she had terminal cancer. And I simply sat on the bed. I said, how do you feel? She said, well, how am I supposed to feel? You know, I've got a death sentence. I'm not ready to die. All of my loved ones, every time they come to see me, they're afraid it'll be the last time. How do you think that works? And I said, who says you're going to die? Well, the doctors do. I said, and why should a doctor be believed above and beyond any other truth? And she paused, And I said, do you realize how fallible doctors are? Do you realize how wrong they are most of the time? Do you realize how they fail in their own paradigm? And yet they have been given 100% control over everything in that paradigm. So the question is, why not look at other cultures around the world that don't have chemotherapy, don't have radiation, but have systems of beliefs and rituals and herbs and other things that they use and have actually helped people improve their conditions? After all, people are living longer lives in other parts of the world than the United States. And she thought about that. And so she then began to open herself up to alternatives. And that's where I brought in a special diet every day with massive amounts of juices and cleansing and intravenous vitamin drips. And she reversed her disease and recovered. And they were very surprised at the hospital. Did they want to acknowledge that? No. They would call it of idiopathic origins, of unknown origin was this. And I said, well, it's not unknown to those of us who are in the field. It's unknown to you. And then Dr. Lawrence LeShen and Gerald Kessler, he was the top psychiatrist in New York City, Department of Health, he and I were speaking one night over at the Institute, and he was telling me about a new research he did, but he didn't know what to do with it. And his research absolutely mirrored Lawrence LeShen's, with nothing more than interviews of completely healthy women who have no history of breast cancer. He could determine with a high degree of accuracy which women over the next several years would develop breast cancer based upon how they felt either appreciated and valued and loved or taken for granted, in which case those were the ones that were more susceptible. Now, LeShen had already written about that. Hans Selye was aware of that, and now he was. I said, well, why don't you bring out something and go forward with it? You're in a very powerful position. He said, because no one's going to accept it. No one wants to believe that what you think can impact your health. And that was before Bruce Lipton in the 1980s and others came forward to say, yes, you are what you think, not just what you eat, but why shouldn't you be what you think, since you are what you eat? You eat bad food, you develop disease, you think bad thoughts, you develop also conditions. Could you take us then down that path to show that this is nothing right new, brand new? There have been sparks of light and enlightenment throughout history of people who had this idea. They yes. just didn't have the form to make it a primary paradigm changer.
Yes, that's a great way to start this. And in my theory, what I do is I take it a little further and go and try to explain that is, if you say, well, thoughts affect your biology, it does, but how does it affect it and how does it happen? And I go developmentally, and here's the description. A child is born and they are hungry. And while they're hungry, they're having they're crying because there's something missing, and there's a biology going on at that time. There's the immune system is doing something, the nervous system doing something, the endocrine system is doing something. Then they see a bottle, and we're predisposed, we're designed to pay much attention to what I call culture editors. They pay attention to the mother or they pay attention to a person very quickly because it's a survival mode. So they see they have a physiology, a psychoneuroimmunology at that time. They don't even have much cognition, but they see. And they see a breast or they see a bottle. Then they quench that hunger. They satiate. And there is a psychoneuroimmunology going on at the same time. They don't have a word for it. But you have a psychoneuroimmunology of the need and a psychoneuroimmunology of the satisfaction. Then later they learn the word breast, mother, bottle. But they already have a bio-symbolic, bio-informational process that says, this is what I feel with hunger, this is what I feel when I'm not hungry, this is the symbol that I associate with it, and then they create meaning, but that meaning already has a bio-symbol. This is why then you can shame somebody in the immune system response, because it doesn't respond in a physiological only way, but in a bio-symbolic way. Another example is that from Aristotle's way back and others, they always talked about the hedonic pleasure, just pleasure for the sake of pleasure, and what they call the eudaimonic pleasure, which is pleasure with service, pleasure with meaning, pleasure that is internal rather than an external thing. And a very recent study was done to look at something that's called CTRA, which is an immunological response to adversity. It's about 21 different genes that respond to adversity with antiviral, antibody, and anti-inflammation. So they did psychological testing on these people to divide them into hedonic and eudaimonic. And what they found was, look how intricate the immune system is and how it can discern at even very very specific levels. The people that were hedonic had worse CTRA response to adversity than the people who were eudaimonic. Now, that's Aristotle being proven correct with immunological tests that we didn't have 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. So that's how powerful it is in discerning. And that is a good way to be able to, I think, to understand that, because if you say to a reductionist, a thought can affect your biology and your molecules and your cells. Oh, come on. How can that happen? If you go developmentally, you go from day one, you see that you're creating a biosymbolic world that is much more sophisticated than animals.
The term body-mind has entered our popular vocabulary. And we hear it being used increasingly in medicine, spirituality, and even by those speaking of ecology and the human nature interactions. And like any word that gets overused and enters the popular parlance of society, it gradually becomes meaningless jargon.
Yes.
I think the overuse and abuse of the word empowerment is a good example. So when we consider the body-mind relationship from that psycho-neuroimmunology, how does this change our understanding of the body-mind concept, and what would you define as being the body-mind self from this perspective?
Okay, well, that's another great question. You always have great questions. I think that one way to begin to look at it is, you're right about the mind-body and mindfulness without really giving it operational definitions. I'll give you a very simple operational definition that you can measure, and you can actually, I do it with CEOs, with Fortune 100 companies. Empowerment. The immune system works, it's bimodal. It's either empowered or in helplessness. And what is empowerment? From the simple neutrophil cell to the most complex T cell, it's the same thing. Empowerment means access to resources to overcome a challenge. Disempowerment is no access to resources or the inability to reach the resources to overcome a challenge. If you don't overcome a challenge, then you become helpless and everything starts breaking down. Now, the mind-body, the best way that I can have to, that I can show to understand it, is that science, as you know very well, has an upward or downward causality of things. It says if it's a downward causality, it goes from the consciousness all the way down to the cell. If it's an upward, like medicine, for example, reductionist medicine, it goes from the simplest to the most complex. I'm introducing a third causality, which is a co-emergent causality within a context. It's contextual co-emergence. So things don't just happen from the bottom or up or the up down. They co-emerge, but they co-emerge in a context, and you can't take the context away. So when you look at it that way, you say, okay, mind and body are one because they're co-authoring with each other, but they co-author in a context. And an example would be if you and I are in a room, and our context is an intellectual discussion of mind-body, and all of a sudden a tiger shows up. Well, there's a stressor right now. You have epinephrine, norepinephrine, cortisol. But is the tiger a stressor? No, because if you and I are talking about how to tame tigers, we go, oh, there's a tiger. Bring him in so we can tame him. So it's all contextual, but it's a co-emergence of the situation rather than upward or downward causality.
Very insightful. I appreciate that. Thank you. Right now, throughout academia, starting about 3 years ago, we're beginning to see a new phenomena. Now, I am a big believer in freedom of speech, and I believe that anyone, whether what they're talking about is accurate or factual or inflammatory, should be given that opportunity, because if a person is foolish, they'll just seem more foolish by what they say. But what if you've censored the fool and hence only allow people who you agree with to have that forum? Right now across America, professors are terrified, not just of the Ivy League schools where this originally emanated, but through tenured professors, because they've seen those who want to teach a class, as they historically have done, in part to allow people more deeply critical thinking capabilities. They're now being challenged. Let's say a student says, I don't like the word you just used. I feel offended. Or I don't like how you're teaching. I feel threatened. Immediately they run off to human resources. They generally create a rally. And next thing you know, you're being yes. brought up on charges. And yes. this is common every day. They've even closed down universities. They've gotten the faculty and the administration to fire completely credible professors who've done nothing wrong by any measure of critical thinking. And having taught universities for more than 35 years, I see this happening. I see the dumbing down of the American educational system. Not that every student is dumbed down by any means, but our standards are so low now in many universities and classes that we don't want to offend the parent. The parent will get on the phone and say, my daughter deserves an A. And but your daughter tested at a D. Doesn't matter. You're a bad teacher. I'm going to go after your job. Now, that's not a hypothetical. That's actually happening.
Sure.
So here's the issue. What do you think that does to the person who now weighs everything they say? Am I about to say something, no matter how harmless it is, that could offend someone? Could you imagine today inviting George Carlin, Lenny Bruce, to come and speak on your campus? They wouldn't be allowed.
No.
Remember the old Bob Hope roast, Johnny Carson
yes.
roast, where they'd roast people?
Yes.
Those were hilarious if you've ever watched Don Rinkles and those people skewer the people. Today, none of that would be allowed. That would be considered insensitive and racist and sexist
of
and
course.
Misogynist. So what does this mean to our physical and emotional health, and what is the likely outcome, both to the person who's now in that environment who cannot have the freedom to teach or to share because it may offend someone, and what does it mean for a whole generation who are being spoon-fed the lowest level of real-life experience? They're going to be completely unprepared for the world that they go into, where they then see people who are not going to filter what they say or their feelings toward you, where you've grown up in a cultured environment. Everything has been cultured to your needs, your emotional needs. What will that epigenetically do to the student in the future and their susceptibility to diseases based upon everything being emotional? They don't need any facts. If they feel it, it must be true because I felt it.
Exactly, yes. Well, that's a very important point, because I think I believe personally that political correctness is intellectual fascism. It kills the freedom of expression, and there's too much emphasis on the emotions. If this doesn't feel right, then it's not right. And then what's happening then is that politics come in, and I mean not just by conservative or but just politics comes in, and they begin to do social experiments on biology that has nothing to do with biology. I'll give you a quick example. There was a study that was done by these researchers, women researchers who believed that everything was cultural, that we teach people culturally to be everything. And what they did is a very simple study. They had very young children, and they gave the little boys a doll to play with, a doll, and they gave the girls tanks to play with the tanks. And what happened is that within a couple of weeks, the boys were using the dolls to do sword fighting, and the girls were putting the tanks to bed. So there's biology there. Now, this has nothing to do with chauvinism. It's nothing. It's just a biological propensity that we have that could be culturally shaped, but is there. So when we do these kinds of experiments, these social experiments imposed on science, on the biology, on science that's been developing for hundreds of years, then we create a pseudoscience, and is a pseudoscience of correctness rather than actual evidence of what's going on one way or another. And you're right, professors are really very concerned that they have to say what's correct rather than what biology is telling them, or whatever science they're doing, what is telling them. So this interaction of political correctness with science really creates a lack of resilience. It creates a fragileness, and that doesn't allow the analytical thinking that you were talking about, the questioning of things, even if they're not politically correct. So yes, I think it causes a problem. And what it causes, I think, in my opinion, is that it makes a person weaker. It makes a person less able to have, what is resilience? Resilience is not only thriving, not only overcoming, but thriving. And you can't have that kind of resilience if you're used to everything has to be right, everything has to be correct. I have a friend, a professor, actually, he's African-American, and we were speaking, we were talking to each other one night, and he's kidding around. He said, you know, when I was growing up, I was black. Now I'm an African-American. So I don't understand that. He's kind of kidding around, but he was saying, look, I've been given labels that nobody asked me if I wanted that label or not. Nothing wrong with it, but a person in Cuba, for example, I went to study some centenarians, and in Cuba, I spoke to this woman, a black Cuban, and I said, do you want to be called a black Cuban or African Cuban? He says, no, I want to be called Cuban. That's what I am. So the more that you define and the more you divide, the more you create prejudice and the more you create a significance of the person based on how they look rather than the identity of the person. So you're black or you're this or you're that. And the more you define it, the more you separate the people out of being human beings, whether they're this or that. So, yeah, I think it's a real concern in academia at every level. And it's really not a good prognosis here.
After 9/11, and again after the economic meltdown at the end of the Bush administration and the beginning of Obama's presidency, we witnessed a dramatic increase in people experiencing existential angst, or what you call existential dread. I had a professor of religion from the University of Pennsylvania and Ivy League school on the program once, and he offers the most popular course on the university campus that is titled Existential Angst. And students from all departments, including the medical school and Wharton School of Business, would be on a waiting list to be enrolled. And now there are added existential stresses of climate change, the possibility of nuclear war, and mass shootings that add to people's angst. But I also note that during the same period of time, since 9/11, and more people are getting ill. So would you please speak about the role of existential angst or dread, and how it can play into our body-mind relationship that contributes to whether or not we're likely to get ill or not?
Well, one of the concerns is that we know epigenetic transfer, for example, with people that have been at Auschwitz and other concentration camps, they pass on the gene expression because the DNA doesn't change. What changes is the gene expression, a gene expression where they have a higher basal level of cortisol than other people. So they're passing on the alarm. That's one of the things that we need to be aware of. But second, then we have that trauma, and that trauma of the vulnerability of New York with the Twin Towers and so forth. And that causes a massive existential concern about your own mortality and about your lack of safety. And one of the things that Kierkegaard talked about, he said that when you're trying to understand an existential situation with your body alone, you have anxiety. If you go beyond and you try to go, for example, something existential or something transcendental that the body can't deal with, then you have dread and you have anguish. And that can only be dealt with a leap of faith, and not in necessarily a religion, but a leap of faith into your own abilities, a leap of faith into your own groups, and then begin to work on that rather than trying to resolve everything. So I'll give you an example. We can't, and one of the anxieties that we have, existential anxieties, is that we can't predict the future. When people say the foreseeable future, that's foolish. You don't foresee the future. By definition, it's not seeable. But what you can do is that since our brains were designed for the next 150,000 years, they're designed to deal with adversity with curiosity. You can't count on the future, but you can count on your curiosity dealing with the future. So what do? You create better, you cultivate curiosity in the present. So no matter what happens in the future, you can count on your curiosity, not knowing what it's going to be by definition, but you're going to be curious of something. And that's what I find that centenarians have, people who live over 100, who who are healthy, they have a tremendous high level of what's called novelty learning in psychology, and their genes only account to about 20 to 25% for longevity. So it's a concern, but I think that the ways of working that through to reduce that angst that you're talking about is so important.
What might be some of the methods or means people can adapt or practice that will help them deal with existential angst and using the idea from Tibetan Buddhism to transmute the negative and harmful energy of angst and dread into a positive energy that is life-affirming and conducive for living a more enjoyable life?
Well, I think that that the first thing that we need to do as existentially is to decide on our cosmology. What is our transcendence? Are we going to be food for worms? Are we going to meet? Are we going to go through the bardo and into another life? Are we going to meet all the people that we love and we're going to be sit on clouds? Whatever it is, since we don't have a way to really affirm or deny that transcendentalism, then you choose. I want this, and this is what I'm going to have faith in, that I am here just for this life, and when I die, there's nothing else. Fine. Or whatever it is, but then what it does is it reduces that fear of the unknown, the fear of the death, because you decide, okay, I'm going to be that. I know some atheists that are much more compassionate than the strongest religious person, and vice versa. But what I see in centenarians is that they have resolved that. They will tell you their cosmology. They don't talk about it that way. But I say, well, so what's going to happen afterwards? And they all have faith in the cosmology that they believe in, whether it's God or not. So I think that's the first thing, to have a cosmology, clean it up. Nobody can prove it for me. So I'm going to believe it. I'm going to take that leap of faith that Kierkegaard talked about, and that's how I'm going to live, with that premise. That reduces a tremendous amount of anxiety. And then there's some Tibetan techniques, as you said, that can be applied, like the four immeasurables and other things that you can do to reduce it. But if you don't resolve that, in the back of your mind kind of thing, you're going to be wondering, well, yes, I know I'm here now, but what's going to happen next, and what's going to happen to the people that I love, and how am I going to live? And that anxiety is running your life, and is running your sense of anguish without having any resolution. So I suggest that the first resolution that we make is, okay, let me find out what I'm going to believe, and it's a leap of faith. No scientist can tell you, or no theologian can tell you either way. So it's a matter of faith, and then putting work into that faith, which are their techniques to do, and so forth. But I think that's a vital issue that most of us don't even think about, or we believe it without really putting the time into it to say, okay, let me really evaluate my cosmology. Let me really evaluate this and see what it is. I was taught this, but what is it that my experience tells me? And then you find some kind of hybrid middle ground or something, but then you're done with it. And then the fear of death dissipates or is diminished significantly, I think, from the work that I've done with some of the people that I work with.
Then you're telling us that you have to prepare yourself for what you want to believe in. It shouldn't just be given to you. It's something you have to come to on your own. And in that context, when you look at modern American culture, and especially right at this historical moment, from my perspective, there is an unusual amount of fear-mongering and denigration.
Yes. Yes.
And even outright hatred towards people perceived as the other.
Exactly.
Even at even at Pacifica, the one of my sister stations where I've been on WBAI for 42 years, the longest running non-commercial radio program in American history, daily program, I see hatred. I even the station manager called me and said that racial epithets, he is from Jamaica, have been hurled against him. Because people don't like him. Well, you might not like someone or what they do, but that gives you no right to denigrate them and try to shame them. And so then you go to work each day knowing that the very environment you're in and the people you're surrounded by may hate you. And that has an enormous psychological impact and epigenetic impact. And now we're beginning to witness backlashes. For example, increasingly, men are being accused of sexual predation, and also women are being more sexually harassed or abused, and there's a war between those who believe in the freedom to possess military assault weapons or those who don't. And our culture is becoming more and more unraveled and confused, and the hypocrisy is palpable. For example, They use the Academy Awards, which I don't watch anyhow because there's only so much narcissism I can handle at any given
right.
moment before my head explodes. And so people already feel entitled and always to be deferred to. Now they're up there saying how they hate gun control. You know, they want gun control. They don't want you to have guns. And yet the very people saying this, like Jennifer Lawrence, she's starring in a movie right now, The Red Sparrow, which is extraordinarily violent. So violent, my daughter walked out of it. And George Clooney, again, look at all the violent movies and the weapons he has. And at the same time, they're telling you should be against this kind of society acceptance of weapons. They're using weapons to further their career, make their extraordinarily rich salaries. And then at the presentation, there are 500 armed guards, yes. police. And then when they go out, they have armed bodyguards. Every one of these people have armed bodyguards. And I just think, is anyone seeing this contradiction? You know, if you're that much against something, then don't profit from it on the one hand and then excoriate it with the other side of your mouth. But we are a nation right now that is caught up in a toxic cultural belief system. And I believe that that is definitely contributing to many people's poor quality of life and even some young people's even killing themselves. Your thoughts, please.
No, I agree completely. I agree that all of those things cause immunological deficiencies, that level of stress, that level of existential hypocrisy where you say one thing and you live another. It's incompatible. Our health depends on how authentic we are with ourselves. If you say that you believe in this, then live it rather than talk it. If you don't live it, your biology is not gaining whatever it is that you need, whether you're an atheist or whether you're a conservative or liberal. It doesn't matter. It's just that if you live it, then you're in tune. It's like archetypes, for example, the archetype of the father. In 150,000 years that we have as modern Homo sapiens, there's been a trial and error in everything. And the archetype is like, what is the best tool for the right, for the particular context? So, for example, the best archetype for dealing with a child is the father or the mother, whatever it is. If you become the lover, it becomes a problem. If you become the visionary, it becomes a problem. So each archetype has to be played out in a context. And interestingly, people start getting sick when they pull out of an archetype. People that, like, for example, Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs was a visionary, but he was a visionary 24/7. He had a hard time moving from visionary to friend, visionary to lover, visionary to father, and he burned out. I'm not saying that's what caused his cancer, but it certainly created a terrain to make it easier to be expressed.
I'd like for you to address also, following in that mindset you're into right now, our dominant culture is highly prejudicial. Everyone is against some other group or people. And prejudice is so rampant in the United States right now. Look at MSNBC, look at Fox, look at NPR, look at PBS. People who have gained power within that given structure then bring forth in different ways their beliefs, as if these are the right beliefs, the only belief, the true belief, and if you don't believe in this, something's wrong with you. One of the most common beliefs right now is that being a man, and just in and of itself, is a pathology. I've actually heard this stated. And yes. Therefore, all young boys should be feminized, because
yes.
if they in any way follow masculine tendencies, they'll be a part of a rape culture.
Yes.
And where I fully support the legitimacy of anyone in the Me Too movement or not who has been sexually violated, that is a legitimate and constant concern that all of us should have, the sanctity of right of another human being. But that very same movement now is getting people who've gone from making a legitimate claim for us to pay attention to what's wrong when a person gets raped, but we do not protest all the killings around the world. The right now, today, I have right in front of me from the Associated Press, 50,000 children in Yemen have died of starvation and disease so far just since January. And yet Ask the average person in the United States, or ask the average woman, or ask the person who's supporting Me Too, a legitimate concern, and I support that. What about the women in other countries? What about the women in Saudi Arabia who are beheaded and lashed? If you're raped in Saudi Arabia, you are lashed and frequently put in prison, not your rapist.
Exactly.
Do we have this concern for all women, all human beings, or is it only particular types under certain conditions? And I'm very concerned that there's going to be a backlash when you start bringing in trivial issues that are not a legitimate part of an initial discussion. And I'm seeing a lot of young people, especially more radicalized young people, who do not have the maturity to realize that before you make an action and react, use reason. Americans react. We don't use reason. Only a small percentage do. And then reason, what is the likely outcome of this, and how can we help this situation? How can we help the victims? But which victims are we not helping? For example, and then I'd like your extended answer on this. I was traveling around America filming people who were caught, possibly for the first time in their life, in the economic trap. They had built up a standard of living and a quality of life that their current income and downsizing after 2007 could not support. And I saw some qualities that lacked reason or common sense. For example, why didn't you sell your house and get out of that predicament? And the answer would be, well, our daughters knew that if anyone knew that we were out of work, the true story, two NASA scientists who had been living high, and their daughters came to expect a certain standard. So even when the parents had no job, were bleeding through all their savings, the daughters insisted, the two teenage daughters who I also spoke with, were insisting that they still be able to go to the mall with credit cards, even though they couldn't pay the credit cards, and buy stuff because, as one of the daughters said, well, you know, with our friends, when someone loses their job, we shun those people. So we didn't want to be shunned. And so guess where I interviewed that family of four, two daughters and a husband and wife? I interviewed them in a park in Florida near Cape Canaveral, a park that was known for people who would go there because they had no other place, were homeless. When I walked up around their SUV, they were heating noodle soup on the radiator of their car. Lost everything, but they lost it without stopping to change anything within their belief system. That's how powerful beliefs can be. And you could imagine the health consequences. Imagine the health consequences to the people who had their homes foreclosed on. How many demonstrations did we have in America by people who are now demonstrating and frequently rightly demonstrating? But why did we choose not to demonstrate when 27 million Americans, over 7 million people, homes were foreclosed on? They had no place to go unless they had a friend or couch surfed or in a basement or in their cars. Or no place. We didn't. And what about all the guys who came back from Vietnam affected by Agent Orange, or came back from Iraq and Afghanistan with post-traumatic stress disorder and blowing their brains out 24 a day? We didn't. And what about the 16 million hungry children? We didn't protest. And what about the 3.5 million homeless children who get out of school each day and have no school, home to go to? We didn't do a damn thing. Mm-hmm. So on. And what about stopping wars where other people around the world, like these children in Yemen, that's, we're supporting the war in Yemen. We got troops on the ground. We're supporting Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates. So what is it about us that is so unique that our empathy or our concern or our outrage is extremely nano-sized and monotheistic directed? Take your time, please.
Yes, those are very powerful questions and very complex. But I'll start with the way that we market things, whether it's an illness or, well, this is fibromyalgia is more popular than tuberculosis, that kind of thing, is based on two things. If you don't have my product, you're not good enough. Or if you don't get what I'm selling you, something bad is going to happen to you. Those two things. It goes to the ego or to the fear. both fear, but one is ego and the other one's the catastrophe that's coming up. So then we decide what illnesses is the one that we need to take care of and pay attention to, what genocide are we going to be able to respond to, and it becomes a marketing issue. And the person that has the biggest lobby and the biggest marketing and the sexiest way of presenting things is the one that wins. And this is why, for example, the Tibetan Buddhists the psychology of Tibetan Buddhists is over 1,500 years old. Ours maybe 150. And they do something that they call the empathic joy, which is that they send a celebration of joy to everyone in the meditation, independent of who that person is. And that's one of the strongest antidote to envy. Or they send love to anyone independent of who they are. So what it does is it says, okay, look, we're all together here. And if one is suffering, we're all suffering. And there's no pick and choose. So this is the sexy genocide of the month. Relationships, the same thing. The soulmate of the month. And it's all based on that marketing. And marketing in the sense of what you sell to the culture. Of what is acceptable, what is not, what is sexy, what is not, including illnesses, which is so interesting. Some people are very embarrassed if they have a particular type of illness. And in other countries, it's tuberculosis, for example, has a really bad stigma in the industrialized world, where in other places, tuberculosis is just like when you have MS here or fibromyalgia or whatever. So it gets so... it gets into such a sense of marketing of ideas that we lose perspective and we lose the sense that you were saying that what happens to all these other people that are having all the suffering, well, they're just not in. They're not popular enough. And going back to initially your question you were asking about the feminizing of men, I wrote an article for Thrive Global about masculinizing femininity and what are the effects of that. For example, women will go to the market and they mimic male power. They power suit and have to be stronger than the man to win. And unfortunately, that's true in a lot of corporations. 50 years ago, it was unheard of for women to have cardiovascular problems. They know women are protected. They're somehow is their hormones. And very seldom would you see 50, 60 years ago problems with the cardiovascular level that you're seeing now. Now it's equal. Men or women are equal. They're masculinizing themselves in a sense of having to mimic male power. And the men are having to feminize themselves in order to be acceptable and so forth. And it has nothing to do with sexuality. It has to do with the image that you create that the culture will support without being aware that it has biological consequences in your health and in your longevity.
Your more recent research has focused on how we subconsciously or unconsciously teach our bodies and immune systems to get sick.
Yes.
Do you have any new insights you've discovered from applying this theory? Please share it.
Yes. For example, I always, when I give a technique, as you know, I always say that this is not to replace medical treatment, and it should be always with the connection with a professional. But one example is hypertension. You have hypertension, and it's epidemic. And if it's essential, which is the hypertension that you can't really find a cause, it's not your kidneys, it's not your heart, it's not your cardiovascular, but you have hypertension. Well, you treat it anti-stress, and it doesn't work that well. I mean, you do a meditation, and your blood pressure goes down, and then it goes right back up 15 minutes later. And the problem is that that is necessary but not sufficient to deal with it. So what I'm proposing is that hypertension is learned, but it's a learned consciousness of an urgent present. As you're saying, you're teaching your body. Here's how you teach your body hypertension if it's essential, if it's not something physical or with clear physical origin. You're saying to your body, I am going to live in an urgent present. And the only way that I can be in an urgent present is to have blood pressure going up so it can get me ready to fight or flight, epinephrine and norepinephrine going up so it can get me ready. So you're teaching a consciousness of a present and urgency. And one of the things that I do is rather than changing with a meditation, which are good, or relaxation, is how do we change that urgent present? And one of the things you can begin to do, very simple for your audience, is you sit and you do your relaxation, whatever you're going to do, and then see yourself moving in slow motion. And at first you're going to actually feel anxious because you're not used to moving in slow motion. When you finish your meditation, you do everything slower to change the mindfulness, to change the what's called the default mode in neuropsychology. You're driving. I did it the other day. I wanted to practice it, and I practiced it quite a bit. And there were four lanes, and one of the lanes, there was a truck. And you know, trucks always go slower. So I purposely went behind that truck so that truck could signal to me the slowing down, the creation of the sense of slow motion. You go to a supermarket, and the cashier is very slow, and you're getting all uptight. Okay, now I want to be able to see this cashier as my teacher for the moment to slow down. And then you tune into even the way that person is breathing. So as you do this over and over again, your consciousness begins to change. And I have seen some really significant changes in blood pressure by doing that, by changing the urgent present into a present that has a sense of time that can be elongated. And that's how centenarians are also. Centenarians, they don't rush for anything. And they think they have the rest of the world and time in front of them. I asked a centenarian, 104, about his garden. And I said, this garden looks really good. What are your plans? He said, well, my plans are in 4 years, it's going to be incredible how this garden's going to be. 104-year-old man. So they elongate time. And the hypothalamus, which has that internal clock, will listen to the biology that you create biosymbolically, not just the circadian rhythms, but the way that you begin to look at the world. And as I mentioned earlier, it's only 20%. Longevity is only 20% genetics. The rest is the biosymbolic world that they live in. And I think that, for example, for hypertension, that's a really good method of beginning to change that. And I'm oversimplifying it because it's a little bit more complex than that, but basically beginning to see how you're teaching your body to be on hyper alarm constantly. And this is not something that I said. Stuart Wolf, who was an authority on chaos theory and cardiovascular illnesses, he basically said that we teach our bodies hypervigilance and hyperalarm, and our bodies will respond with hypertension.
Hmm. Give us an idea, before we end our program in 3 minutes, of what a person must do to physically deconstruct their negative cultural and anthropological conditioning and psychologically that is a causal factor in becoming ill.
What I call the fishbowl effect is a nice metaphor to be able to begin to frame this. Fish are in a bowl and they don't know that there's anything beyond the fishbowl. Well, that's what our culture does. It puts us in that fishbowl and we're not able to see. And if we try to get out and become the outliers or go beyond the pale, which has a negative connotation, then they put you right back in and they tell you, well, no, look, you're 45. You don't need to dress like that anymore. You don't want to go back to school. You want to start dealing with your retirement. And you go into retirement consciousness, which is one of the ways to get sick. But the thing to do is that you have to look at who are your co-authors in whatever life you're living. And look at your people that you see, five people that you see on a regular basis, and assess their health, their way of looking at the world, and those are the people in the fishbowl with you. It could be good, could be bad. So what you do is you begin to then pull out and become an outlier here, an outlier there, and then look for people to support you because we're social beings. We need confirmation. And that's one way to begin to change the consciousness rather than the behavior. The behaviors come and go, but the consciousness is the goggles that you use to look at the world. So that's a simple one of the simple techniques that you can begin to use. And you'd be amazed, or people in your audience, when you look at those 5 to 8 people, look at their health, look at how they think, look at how prejudiced they are or not, look how rigid they are, and look how much they talk about illnesses or not, and how healthy they are. And what that does is saying, this is my fishbowl. Eventually I'll fall into this because it's the reality that I'm sharing. And then you have to decide, this is a good fishbowl, and but I'm going to break and find some other people, or this is a bad fishbowl, and I'm still going to break and find some other people. So that's a simple way to begin to really break that default mode that I've been talking about.
Excellent advice. Mario, thank you once again for coming on, and I look forward to our next conversation.
My pleasure, and thank you for your wonderful questions. They always are very complex and very deep.
To our guests, you've been listening to Dr. Mario Martinez, And Mario is a clinical psychologist specializing in psychoneuroimmunology and anti-aging. His latest book is Mind, Body, Self, How Longevity is Culturally Learned and the Causes of Health Inherited. His website, biocognitive.com. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.